Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for August 10th, 2025, the cover story, The 36 Who Fought Back. They were systematically raped during Guatemala's civil war. 4 decades later, they made a final bid for justice. And then, Master Amateur, a new career-spanning essay collection shows how Jamaica Kincaid has never lost touch with the mischievous creativity of her 7-year-old self. And then from the diagnosis section of the New York Times Magazine, the man had grown so weak he couldn't stand. After weeks of treatment, a doctor figured out what was missing. But first, the 36 who fought back. And I should let you know that this is a photo essay, but I am sure you still will be able to appreciate the stories of these women. The text was written by Annie Coryell. In the early 1980s, a brutal civil war was raging in remote Guatemalan villages like those around the town of Rabinal. Violence left the countryside dotted with mass graves, and the women in those villages faced another kind of horror. Local forces backed by the government, known as civil defense patrols, rounded up women and girls from surrounding communities, looking for anyone cooperating with so-called subversives. The victims were raped and sometimes held captive for weeks on end, but they survived. 4 decades later, dozens of these women of the region's Achi Mayan population came together to prosecute their attackers for crimes against humanity. In April of this year, the final case in their years-long fight went to trial. With many of the women in their 80s, it was a last chance to see the men answer for their crimes. If convicted, the former patrollers would go to prison, and if not, they would return to their villages where they had lived down the road from some of the women for decades. "What happened was against my will," said Candelaria Zolop Morales, one of the plaintiffs in the case. "They raped me, and it left me afraid." She was just 19 at the time. These crimes happened during the darkest period of the war that consumed Guatemala for more than 3 decades. From 1982 to 1983, the country's then-dictator, Efrain Rios Montt, ordered his U.S.-supported military to eradicate guerrilla opposition. It was a brutal period in a conflict that, in total, saw more than 200,000 people killed or disappeared, the majority of them indigenous Mayans. The United Nations would later conclude that the state committed genocide as soldiers and the patrollers carried out a scorched earth campaign. Guatemalans still hang posters of those who vanished. Decades ago, some survivors began a remarkable effort to confront this past. One of them was Jesus Tecu Osorio. As a child, he survived one of the most notorious massacres of the 1980s and was abducted by a patroller who forced him to work for months on a farm. In 1993, Jesus led an early effort by survivors of the killings to prosecute those responsible, including the people who murdered his family. Eventually, he created a legal aid society dedicated to gathering evidence to bring other perpetrators to account. While interviewing Achi women about the violence in their villages, Jesus and his team heard many say they had been raped by patrollers and soldiers. Jesus wondered, could these state actors be prosecuted for sexual violence just as they had for their role in the massacre? In 2011, the women decided to try. Guided by the Legal Aid Society and lawyers who were also Mayan, they started meeting in Rabinal to build their case. For years, the women had barely spoken about what had happened, about brutal assaults that left some of them pregnant. One had never even told her husband, but as they met, their courage grew. "I feel more like talking because it isn't just me," one of the women said. By 2014, Jesus's team had enough evidence to go to trial. Only some were named plaintiffs, but the case relied on the testimonies of 36 women. There were early signs that gave them hope, like a landmark ruling in a similar trial in 2016 and the arrest in 2018 of several former patrollers in the Achi women's own case. Then came a setback. A judge freed the captured men, finding the women's testimony insufficient, and dismissed the case. The group kept pushing and managed to remove that judge from the case. In 2022, the first trial ended with the conviction of 5 men for crimes against humanity. The final trial against the last 3 patrollers began in January. Paulina Expada Alvarado, who was held captive for 25 days at a military barracks near her town, was another plaintiff. She took the stand in the courtroom, describing to the judges how she and others, including a cousin, endured the assaults. For years, her community cautioned against speaking out, believing nothing would be done. "That's why we have to persist," she said, "because if we leave it be, it will stay like this, sealed away." When the court was in session, the women rode a bus from Rabinal to the Supreme Court in Guatemala City. They traveled several hours each way. The women attended every hearing, whether they were plaintiffs or not. It was the first time some of the women had been in the same room as their assailants since the attacks. A judge read out the women's names, noting their attendance. Simeon Enriquez Gomez, Pedro Sanchez Cortez, and Felix Tom Ramirez were all accused of raping the plaintiffs. One was also charged with imprisoning them at the barracks. They all claimed they were innocent. Paulina's cousin, Pedrina Expada Rodriguez, was also taken to the barracks. She testified about another man, a soldier who protected her. While she was being held captive, she said, that soldier hid her from the others when they came looking for a victim to assault. He became a protected witness in the case, and he confirmed Pedrina's account, a crucial piece of evidence. But many of the women in the courtroom would never see their attackers stand trial. In the decades since the case began, several of the original 36 women had died. Estefana Teku Ojom says she was raped by soldiers that she never had the chance to identify. She joined the Achi women all the same. The trial of the 3 patrollers lasted for 4 months, with testimony concluding in April. The women and the 3 men waited weeks for a decision. On May 30th, the judges delivered the verdict. They declared the patrollers guilty and handed down sentences of 40 years to all 3. The judges ordered the state to pay reparations to the women, which would include scholarships for their children and grandchildren. They also said that school children in Guatemala should learn about the crime so they would never be forgotten. Rulings in cases like that of the Achi women are an essential step toward truth and transitional justice, a spokesman for the Office of the President of Guatemala said. It confirms that it's possible to move forward toward a country where memory and dignity are the foundation of lasting peace. After the verdict, the women gathered outside the courthouse to perform a Mayan invocation to their ancestors, spreading flowers and lighting candles. Much remains uncertain since the victory. The patrollers' lawyers have challenged the verdict, and so far the men remain free. Reparations will likely never materialize, and the legal group representing the women lost funding when the Trump administration cut foreign aid through USAID. And the women will always live with the crimes committed against them, even if their assailants no longer live nearby. Some of the Achi women were left unable to bear children. others who were impregnated by their rapist miscarried. But Candelaria bore a child from the assault who survived, a daughter. While growing up, the girl asked her about her father. Candelaria told her the truth, and her daughter said she understood. "I'm going to take care of you when I'm older," she said. "I've come to save you." The daughter is now in her 40s and has a family of her own. Her acceptance of what happened, like the verdict, is a reminder of the long aftermath of war and the many shapes that reckoning can take. Annie Curiel, who wrote the text for this photo essay, is a Latin America correspondent for the New York Times. Our next article, after 50 years of writing, Jamaica Kincaid insists she's still an amateur. A new career-spanning essay collection shows how she has never lost touch with the mischievous creativity of her 7-year-old self. This article was written by Niella Orr. In June, I visited Jamaica Kincaid at her home in Vermont, and not long after we met, she walked me over to a bust of Thomas Jefferson looming over a shaded corner of her garden, introducing me to him like he was an old friend or a hostage. "Very controversial, but we will explain," she said. "When summer is over, he spends the winter in the basement." Then she showed me a plant called the twin leaf, which has one frond divided into two nearly identical leaflets. "The two halves are not identical. Is that Jefferson or no?" Kincaid asked, showing me the fraternal leaves with professorial wonder and not a small amount of delight. Its scientific name, Jeffersonia diphylla, was given to it by the botanist Benjamin Smith Barton, one of Thomas Jefferson's contemporaries. "Before anyone thought of his twin nature," she said of the president's duality. Kincaid is an admirer of Jefferson's writing on horticulture, so when she discovered this plant, it appealed to her. She saw that it spoke to his fundamental contradiction as both a theorist of democratic liberty and slaver. "One has to contemplate these histories," Kincaid said, "and so I find him a good person to have a conversation with." At 76, Kincaid is both youthful and monumental, a down-to-earth person possessed of a towering intellect. Although she has shrunk some over the years, she still stands at nearly 6 feet. Her dark brown hair was parted down the center of her scalp, woven into two cute plaits, little commas curling near her shoulders. She wore a silver watch with the clock face on the inside of her wrist as a tribute to her late father. Her laugh, which I heard often, was filtered through her accent, an undulating Antiguan inflection that swayed like a gently rocked boat. Kincaid's sprawling garden sits on a bountiful property in North Bennington beside a house originally built and inhabited by Robert H. Woodworth, a pioneer of time-lapse photography. Here she begins developing her ideas, influenced by the cultivated wildness outside. In an essay included in her new book, Putting Myself Together, Writing, 1974-2, to be published on August 5th by Farrar, Strauss, and Giraud, she asserts that, rather than creating a garden in the conventional way, overdetermined by the gardener's expectations, she favors a looser approach. "I was never really making a garden in that way so much as I was having a conversation," she writes, "a conversation with all the components, all the attributes, all the dangers, all the failures and pitfalls, all the moral and immoral dilemmas, all of the history of the garden and the way it has formed, starting with the Edenic prelapsarian ideal, idol, and its postlapsarian catastrophe." By working in the garden and noting what she learns, she puts herself in unexpected dialogue with predecessors like Jefferson. Maybe Kincaid likes thinking alongside Jefferson because, like him, like the garden we walked in, her own work lives in tension with itself, yoking the violent and the peaceful, the mundane and the metaphysical, channeling the chaos and collision of existence. Kincaid's stories, in one way or another, concern how we can achieve self-discovery within that chaos. That's the reality Kincaid has tried to render, intricately unfolding chronicles that record what it's like to bumble through time, grasping for meaning. She is animated by maximum receptivity to experience and the way that experience can deepen into knowledge. Her narrators take in the world's enormity from acute, personal angles, spelunking into an experiential mess that Kincaid calls the swirl. "I just sort of plunge into things," she told me. Putting Myself Together captures her questing sensibility through a half century's worth of personal essays and cultural criticism that provide a model of sumptuous, slow thinking. It lets us see how Kincaid made her mark decades ago in pieces that attempted to describe the passage of time across different scales, whether the entrancing dilapidation of New York in the 1970s or the extraction of colonization over centuries. She is seized by what it means to be human in a world that finds new ways to devalue the human. Her writing gets to the root of things. "It takes me so long to write," she told me. "You see me in the garden walking around, just plundering around thinking of a sentence. Sometimes it takes me a week to finish a sentence just to get it right." We took a break from strolling in the garden and had lunch. I spied, many yards away, a young deer tiptoeing onto the property. "Where?" Kincaid asked urgently, and I pointed. She searched the green expanse of lawn, but by then he was gone. "I fire bullets at him, but not to hit him," she said. "I like to just go and fire the gun so that the smoke..." And she trailed off, nearly whispering, leaving the suggestion to linger between us. "He's very beautiful," she said. "He's just very young and doesn't understand that he's going to be somebody's dinner." For two of the 3 days that I visited her, a shotgun lay on her kitchen table, the barrel trained on a wall, safely turned away from people, the butt resting on top of a copy of Virgil's The Aeneid, which she was rereading. During our time together, that juxtaposition between the visceral and cerebral made me wonder, is that Kincaid or no? The cover of Putting Myself Together is an image of Kincaid's style in the 1970s when she was coming of age in a cataclysmically vivid New York City. It's a picture of clothing pinned to a wall, a brown felt hat like one that belonged to her dad, a pink polo shirt, a skirt with a pack of lucky stripes tucked into the waist, red-ribboned ballet flats. Kincaid directs the photo shoot in shadow, her hand fixing the outfit in profile from just outside the frame. The collection is something of an answer to the question of who the woman that wore the clothes was then and who she became. It collates early work from publications like The Village Voice, Rolling Stone, and literary journals alongside later works for The New Yorker. Despite its breadth, it doesn't have the feel of an intentional autobiography or memoir, of a wizened writer making sense of her life in words. "I'm not a professional writer," she laughed. "I'm an amateur writer." The vulnerability associated with beginner's mind is a crucial part of her repertoire. "I have this theory that you are who you are at 7, Kincaid told me. "When you reach 7, that's your life, and that you just repeat until you're 100. Until you die, you're 7. I find great comfort in that." She looked up at the ceiling in her sunroom, which is also her office. "I feel all the things that are interesting about me developed at that precise age. My curiosity, my observation." Kincaid, who was born Elaine Potter Richardson in St. John's, Antigua, in 1949, has spent her life cultivating the kaleidoscope perception of that 7-year-old self. When she was little, Elaine's loving but ambivalent mother gave her books so that she could do her own reading without being bothered. Those books introduced the girl to life under the psychological and cultural influence of British colonialism. She was educated with English primers and taught the classics by Shakespeare and Milton and Wordsworth, and she believes her mother, Annie, picked her first name from a Tennyson poem. On Kincaid's 7th birthday, her mother gave her the Concise Oxford English Dictionary. At that fateful age, Kincaid, a bright child who had developed a talent as a class clown, misbehaved at school and was given what her teacher thought would be an onerous punishment. Copying out the first two books of Milton's Paradise Lost by hand. She had no electricity, she said, and would have to copy the passages by lamplight or moonlight. Along the way, she found herself identifying with Lucifer because of his rebellious spirit. Her first act of interpretation, as she described it to me, was connecting the fall of Lucifer with the story of Percy the Bad Chick, an anthropomorphic bird from a children's primer. Percy's mother warns him not to fly over the farmyard's fence, but he does so anyway and crashes to the ground. This moment of linking a children's book with one of the Western canon's most acclaimed works was a premonition of her singular vision. "Often I was punished for speaking," Kincaid explained to me. "I was punished for being intelligent. They say I could talk before I walked, which is usually not true. The other thing they used to say when I was little is that I had a phenomenal memory because I could just recall things. And then at one point, it just became a curse because I would correct people and they would say, 'What a memory you have,' but in a scornful way. And so I just learned not to speak." Kincaid's parents sent her to New York in 1965 at age 16 to work and send money home. She lived in Westchester and worked as a nanny and later as a receptionist at Magnum Photos, then attended and dropped out of Franconia College in New Hampshire. She did not send money home as instructed, disliking the idea of being separated from the fruits of her labor. She continued her youthful rebellion and separation from her mother by deciding to write. This was all driven by Kincaid's sense that, as she said in a 2003 interview with The Believer, her mother had written her life. Relocating to the city was a critical act of self-authorship. "One day I just packed up my car and said, 'I'm going to be a writer,' and I moved to New York." She settled into a house in Lower Manhattan and paid $175 a month in rent, which was often late. She cut her hair short and dyed it blonde. While hanging out with friends, she decided she would change her name from Elaine to Jamaica Kincaid, picking a Caribbean first name and a Scottish surname so that she could write without her parents finding out. Eventually, Ingenue magazine took a chance on an idea of hers, assigning her to interview popular figures about what they were like at 17. Very quickly, she moved on to more ambitious assignments, reviews and reportage, which she calls observations, at other stalwart publications of the era: Rolling Stone, Ms., The Village Voice. While reporting for those assignments, she met the New Yorker writers George W.S. Trow and Ian Fraser, with whom she became close. She went to parties, frequented Andy Warhol's factory, and sang background for Holly Woodlawn, one of the Warhol superstars. It all looked very glamorous, but Kincaid has a slightly different memory of her social life. "I'd go to a lot of parties because I had no money, and it was the only time I'd eat." In 1974, Trow introduced her to William Shawn, the eminent editor of The New Yorker, and she began to write for the magazine's Talk of the Town section, a form that played to her wicked sense of humor, inventiveness, and strength for capturing offbeat details. Talk stories, which were then published without bylines, allowed her to experiment with her voice on the page. I think that was one of the best things for a writer, to just write anonymously when you're young, she said. Kincaid's talk pieces are wry but slyly vivacious, etching quick-lived events. A benefit party thrown for Gary, Indiana, whom Kincaid described as the punk poet and pillar of Lower Manhattan society. A press breakfast for the economist Milton Friedman's PBS series, which she reviewed in the form of an expense account. A panoramic look at what a dozen random people were doing one Monday at noon. Into lasting portraits of a deliriously dire straits city. 2 years later, she became a staff writer for the magazine. I was the only black woman there, which I didn't notice, Kincaid said, because, she said, she was too focused on her work. When I was there, I wasn't thinking about my own race so much. I was thinking about, how can I write? I was so obsessed with writing. She remembers that the white women working there as secretaries and fact-checkers were skeptical of her rise at the magazine and kept asking her how she got her job, even after she'd already explained her story. But by and large, it was a place to thrive. In 1979, she married one of William Shawn's sons, the composer Alan Shawn, with whom she had a baby and moved to Vermont. Years later, they moved into the Time Lapse house with their two children, Annie and Harold. Kincaid and Shawn divorced in 2002 after a turbulent split. They are now friends. In 1978, The New Yorker published her short story, Girl, a hypnotic list of domestic instructions dictated by a mother to her daughter. It made her famous. The story is still widely anthologized. In the introduction to Putting Myself Together, Henry Louis Gates writes that Kincaid's innovation in Girl was to write, as it were, not exactly beyond race, but with one's blackness assumed, an uncommented on default. In the late 70s, black writers took cues from the black power and black arts movement, asserting and elevating the specificity of black experiences. Kincaid's work, while not unique in its approach to the assumed black voice, offered an array of witty and playful formal innovations on the sound of it. Most American high schoolers tend to encounter Girl first, which is interesting because it's such a specifically Antiguan piece, the novelist and essayist Naomi Jackson told me. So much of the vocabulary is opaque to people who are not just not from the Caribbean, but not from Antigua specifically. The story's experimental form shaped later writers. David Foster Wallace modeled part of his postmodern novel, Infinite Jest, on the incantatory phrasing and sentence structure in Girl. Jonathan Galassi, Kincaid's longtime editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, told me that the blur between fiction and nonfiction is part of her appeal. Indeed, many of Kincaid's multifarious works, which dig into the complex relationship between personal agency and systemic power, anticipate contemporary autofiction. Annie John and Lucy explore the simultaneously loving, vexing, and unequal relationships between mothers and daughters. In A Small Place, Kincaid is gripped by the afterlife of colonial violence, parsing its impacts with elliptical curiosity. Stylistically, she favors a give and take between the imagistic efficiency of poetry, potent phrases and spot-on descriptions, and the slow-moving inefficiency of real-time revelation. Her writing on gardening, represented amply in the new book, reflects a mature version of the interpretive flair she displayed as a girl. Memory is a gardener's real palette, she writes in another piece collected in the book. Memory as it summons up the past. Memory as it shapes the present. Memory as it dictates the future. Jackson, whose parents are from Antigua and Barbados, told me, I think it's not overstating the case that encountering the work of Jamaica Kincaid made it seem possible for me to have a life as a writer. She has taught Kincaid in many of her classes, including a course at Rutgers University Newark, devoted entirely to her work. Galassi argued that Kincaid's mix of genres and rhetorical strategies and emotional registers, her justifiable anger, for example, mixed with her dreaminess, makes her unique and original, not a product publishing trendy, palatable titles. She's so essential to literature, he told me, that if there wasn't a Jamaica Kincaid, we would have invented her. I would like to take a brief moment now to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In Kincaid's sunroom, an inactive wasp's nest hung from the ceiling. The fragrant scent of Douglas fir in the house's beams mingled with the sounds of reggae music emanating from a speaker on the other side of the room. The music's recursive, slow, dragging rhythms kindled the reflective atmosphere. The writing is so internal, even when it's an external thing, she said. I do very much believe in the unconscious, and it's not exactly the very best way to live. I'll do things and I'll think, what was I thinking? Why did I do that? Putting myself together provides something of an answer, even though Kincaid is adamant that the book is not autobiography or memoir, two labels she believes are usually too reductive to apply to her work. In a 1992 essay called Biography of a Dress, included in the collection, Kincaid writes that she invented herself as a toddler when her mother had a friend pierce her ears, causing days of swelling and pain. In that moment, Kincaid felt a cleavage open up in her sense of herself. I separated myself from myself and I became two people. Two small children then, I was 2 years old. One having the experience, the other observing the one having the experience. And the observer, perhaps because it was an act of my own will, strong then but stronger now, my first and only real act of self-invention is the one of the two I most rely on, the one of the two whose voice I believe to be the true voice. This work of dividing herself between the person doing and the person watching seems like an important step in becoming a writer. Her work's charge comes from the electric encounters with ideas and the mechanisms of her own mind. One such encounter came in 1958, when her mother sent her via steamship to live with her grandparents in Dominica. She found herself in the village of Massacre, outdoors, listening to a teacher read to the class. The village was named in memory of a massacre of native Caribs carried out by the English in 1674, but Kincaid's teacher was speaking about another historical moment. From beneath a tamarind tree, she read to her students a Time magazine article about the segregationist Alabama politician George Wallace. Her teacher asked the class, "What to do in a world like that, with a man like that?" Kincaid suggested sending him Bibles. She was so indoctrinated into English concepts of Christianity and propriety, and his cruelty convinced her that he was a savage in need of civilizing. As she listened to her teacher in the shade of the tamarind tree, she realized that the tree was from India and that understanding opened up so much for her about the entwinements of people and nations. Considering this confluence of time, place, and insight, Kincaid spoke of how the sad, tragic poetry of life comes rushing at you. She continued, "It makes you believe in something greater than yourself, that there is something happening that you can't see." Even now, nearly 70 years later, when she concentrates enough to enter the mental state in which the ideas flow, she can perceive that something greater. She enters the space of suspended girlhood, where she was first struck by the notion that she could chase one thought from where she was, sitting under a tree in Dominica, all the way to another side of the globe. Still the one who went on steamships to Dominica for the first time and to the market with her mother and who learned to do the what to see from reading a magazine, the one who idolized Milton's Lucifer. It all goes back to the voice that took shape under the tamarind tree in Massacre, who learned to connect the massacre of Caribs and the ongoing desecration of colonization to the fact that the tamarind tree is in the Caribbean at all. For the person with a lifelong interest in the way power works, her power is nurturing her access to that impressionable voice, being a student and devotee of it. She knows that maturity is not just about repressing the inner child or cradling her, but learning how to rouse her from sleep. The secret is in recognizing how much of her she still has access to. It's in honoring the ephemeral plants that emerge and disappear like the pop-up parties and downtown raves she went to in the 70s. Admiring the garden, I praised Kincaid's permissiveness about the self-seeding vegetation growing within it. She scanned the random sprouts around us and said, "It's a strange thing to say, but I feel as if it's me. I would like it if, within reason, I was allowed to do what I wanted to do." In the house made by an inventor of time-lapse photography, Kincaid continued to chart her own shape-shifting 7-year-old and 76-year-old self. I thought that she couldn't view work about her life as autobiography because of her endorsement of amateurism. Maybe the act of being an authority of herself felt horrifying and inauthentic. What did she think? She answered with something more profoundly personal. "It sounds awfully wooey, you know, kind of hippie-ish, but somewhere I'm still Elaine," she said, "and she doesn't know how to write." We walked back to her sunroom. I wouldn't know how to write an autobiography or a memoir about my childhood, but Jamaica could look at Elaine and write about her. Weeks after our encounter, I remembered the thing that made her so enthused about Jeffersonia difilla, the twin leaf. She was almost ecstatic whenever she spoke about it, italicizing her speech with emphasis on the plant's ephemerality. "It blooms and then it disappears as if it was never there." She kept saying that. Kincaid's ruminative around the mulberry bush treatment of humanity's fleeting nature on this earth may be the key to her artistic project and its endurance. Humans are circuitous thinkers, not always having epiphanies, except when we are. "I plead guilty to narcissism, but I see myself in everything," Kincaid said. "Wait," she hesitated, started again. "It's not so much that I see myself, but when I'm reading something or when I'm doing something, I'm really in it. I find out everything I can about it or I can manage about it. But left to my own, there's very little that divides me from the world." In the garden, Kincaid was matter-of-fact but thoughtful, smacking mosquitoes and watching out for snails. She considered her impulse to crush them a version of the mischievous Percy girl showing up now. "I don't claim to be moral," she said. "I'm just as bad as the rest or just as capable of being as bad as the rest." I glanced over at her profile, and for a second, she looked a little shy. It's one of the things that just makes you want to stay home because, given the opportunity, you will do something bad. It's irresistible. You have to really work at it. Nyala Orr, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her last feature for the magazine was about female rappers. Orr spent 3 days with Kincaid in her vast garden in North Bennington, Vermont, listening to her hold forth on the connection between mahogany trees and the novel Mansfield Park, why women wrote the most detailed memoirs about mountain climbing, what she believes is the first instance of racial profiling in American literature, and more. "After 3 days, I was ready to quit the internet," Orr says. To paraphrase the meme, "I actually touched grass. It was grounding and a lovely reprieve from the scourge of screen time." And now the diagnosis section of the New York Times Magazine. He was getting weaker and more confused. Could it be his drinking? The middle-aged man had received weeks of treatment before a doctor figured out what was missing. This article was written by Lisa Sanders, MD. The woman struggled to get her 53-year-old husband out of the car and into the just-borrowed wheelchair. She rolled him through the crisp February air to the emergency department at Lawrence and Memorial Hospital in New London, Connecticut. They had driven straight from the neurosurgeon's office, where the physician assistant was shocked by how weak the man had become, how much worse he was than 6 weeks earlier when he last saw the patient. In the ER, the man lay moaning quietly on the stretcher. His blood pressure was low. His heart rate was high. He could barely move his legs on his own, and when the ER doctor lifted each leg and let go, he couldn't hold them up. The doctors were worried something was compressing the man's spinal cord. The patient needed an MRI right away. After the test, the man was given fluids. He hadn't been eating or drinking much for the past few weeks, his wife told the nurse. The MRI showed wear and tear in his neck and some narrowing of the spinal column in his lower back, but it didn't seem enough to cause this profound weakness. Even so, the neurosurgeon who reviewed the results thought they should start him on intravenous steroids to bring down any swelling that might not have been seen on the MRI. That night, after his wife went home, the patient, tired and a little confused, could only provide the admitting doctor with a very basic story. His legs had started hurting a few months earlier. It began with a pins and needle feeling in his feet that over time moved upward, and he had terrible leg cramps. He couldn't sleep, he couldn't work, then he couldn't walk, and now he was here. The doctor found the rest of the history in his chart. Back in September, his primary care doctor sent him for an MRI and tested him for B12 deficiency and, because this was Connecticut, for Lyme disease. His B12 was low, so she started him on a supplement. He didn't have Lyme disease, and that MRI showed some osteoarthritis and mild compression, so she sent him to a neurosurgeon. He was given oral steroids and referred for physical therapy. Neither helped. By December, he was unable to leave the house. He fell several times. By January, he was having problems with his memory. He missed appointments, didn't get ordered lab work. The patient had a long history of drinking, the doctor noted. The previous year, he was found guilty of driving under the influence and had to go to a court-ordered alcohol program. He was drinking less, he told the doctor, but still drinking. He had a drink earlier that day, he admitted, but only one. Many treatments, but no improvement. The lab tests ordered in the ER showed some signs of heavy alcohol use. Drinking could cause a serious neuropathy, though usually it was a loss of sensation rather than the profound weakness he had. Alcohol use disorder has long been associated with severe nutritional deficiencies. Because of poor food intake, and because heavy drinking can impair nutrient absorption. His vitamin B12 was better. He was taking that at home. But his vitamin B1, also known as thiamine, was undetectable. Both of those deficiencies could cause weakness and the kind of nerve pain he had. The memory issues, too, and the confusion. He was started on vitamin B1 and high-dose intravenous steroids. The vitamin B12 was continued. Dr. Bishal Kanal was worried when he took over the case on the patient's 19th day in the hospital. The patient remained unable to walk and was confused. Reviewing the chart, it wasn't clear that he had improved much with the steroids, the vitamin B12, or the thiamine. The patient underwent dozens of tests. His thyroid hormones were normal, so were his vitamin B12 and now his B1 too. His spinal fluid was sent to the Mayo Clinic to look for autoimmune diseases that could attack the brain and the nervous system. The results were not back, but his doctor started him on the treatment for an autoimmune issue just in case. He was seen by neurosurgery, by neurology, by gastroenterology, by rehabilitation medicine, and by psychiatry. All departments made suggestions, but none had discovered the cause of his weakness or his persistent confusion. Finally, Kunal went in to meet the patient. The man's wife was at his bedside, as she had been every day. The patient was not able to lift either leg. His arms were weak and shook so ferociously that he could not drink from a glass. His wrists were almost powerless. His wife was frustrated and worried. He had been in the hospital for so long and still could not get out of bed. Why couldn't the doctors help him? Kunal was struck by all the nutritional issues that the man had from his alcohol use, and yet, according to the testing, they all seemed to be getting better. His albumin and prealbumin, which can decrease when a patient is malnourished, had been low when he first got to the hospital. They were improving. Indeed, all his labs were getting better, but the patient was not. What were they missing? There was another B vitamin that hadn't been tested for, vitamin B6, an essential component in dozens of bodily functions. It's found in many foods, so deficiency seemed unlikely, but Kunal thought it was worth checking. Another possibility came to mind as well. Insufficient dietary copper could mimic the symptoms of vitamin B12 deficiency, but this was usually only seen in those with some kind of gastrointestinal disorder. In rare cases, it could be caused by excessive zinc intake. But alcohol use? A quick review of the medical literature showed a handful of case reports of copper deficiency associated with heavy drinking. So, maybe. The dietary requirement for this mineral was tiny, but it could cause the kind of profound weakness this patient had. He would check for these two deficiencies and wait for the rest of the results to come back. The findings of the many studies continue to trickle in. The Mayo Clinic identified no sign of an autoimmune disease. The B6 level that Kunal ordered was low, but in the normal range. The missing piece. Finally, after 3 days, the results of the copper test came back. The patient had only half as much of this vital element as he should. Copper is essential for many of the chemical functions of the body and brain, and deficiency can cause both short and long-term damage to the frontal lobes, which are involved in thinking and memory storage, and the cerebellum, the coordinating center for both body and brain. Kunal started the patient on intravenous copper. The results were surprisingly fast. Within a day, the terrible tremor disappeared and he could drink from a glass. And after 5 days, he was able to get out of bed and walk, albeit with a walker and closely followed by a nurse pushing a chair on wheels. His wife cried with joy and relief. I met the patient and his wife recently. He has been home from the hospital and subsequent rehabilitation for nearly 4 months. He uses a cane and moves carefully, as if still not quite sure how it's done. His memory is still poor. It is possible it will never get better. Both copper and thiamine deficiency can cause permanent changes. In medicine, we like to work with the idea of Occam's razor, that the simplest single explanation is most likely to be right. But there was a 20th century American doctor, John Bamber Hickam, who offered a counterpoint, that a patient's symptoms might come from multiple diseases at once, rather than from one simple cause. In this case, Hickam's dictum, as it's called, was right. The patient had deficiencies of many necessary nutrients. Kunal came up with the one that others had missed, but it was all the deficiencies together that caused the damage. The patient and his wife have been together since they were teenagers. They tell me there were good years and bad years. His drinking was at the heart of their worst years. He hasn't had a drink since he entered the hospital and is determined to never drink again. His wife is confident that he will not. They vowed for better or for worse, she told me solemnly. But at least now she is certain the worst is over. Lisa Sanders, MD, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her latest book is Diagnosis, Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries. If you have a solved case to share, write to her at lisa.sandersmdnyt@gmail.com. We still have a few moments remaining, so with that time, I will read to you from the Ethicist column from today's edition of the New York Times Magazine. Do I have to let my brother crash with me forever? Am I helping him get on his feet or enabling him to avoid getting the help he needs? As always, the ethical questions are answered by Kwame Anthony Appiah. I come from a large family. My siblings and I are now in our 50s to 70s. Our parents, worn out by so many children, ended up neglecting our needs physically and emotionally in different ways. I hold no grudge. They did their best, and they've been gone for decades. Unfortunately, my younger brother has been couch surfing with me and other siblings for about 20 years. He spent some time living in inexpensive countries on his inheritance, but now the money is gone and he has no job. He has been living with me for the last few years, and as I approach 60, I'm exhausted. I don't feel I can host him much longer. For years, I and others have urged him to get counseling for his anxiety and his difficulties with executive function. We've also suggested that he see a social worker and start building independence, especially as he gets older. He insists he's working on tech projects that will bring in passive income. He's highly intelligent and has big dreams, but nothing has panned out. None of my other siblings can take him in again. I do think he needs counseling and maybe medication. I'm empathetic by nature and I hate the idea of putting him on the street, but would that be what finally gets him to seek professional help? I'm not equipped to be his caseworker. Am I enabling him to avoid the help he needs by continuing to provide him with a place? This letter writer has had their name withheld. And the ethicist responds, from what you say, it sounds as if you're carrying a lot, especially as you get older yourself. It's clear you care about your younger brother and don't want to see him suffer. Still, you're right to wonder whether you're simply enabling a middle-aged man to avoid facing reality and getting the assistance he needs with respect to his mental health and his ability to function. Our obligations to adult siblings, unless they are truly incapable of independence, are real but not unlimited. Most people in our society accept that while family bonds matter, there comes a point when adults are expected to take responsibility for their own lives, or at least to make a genuine effort to do so. You might start by setting clear boundaries. Explain that your home is open to him only if he takes concrete steps toward getting help. But you have to mean it, and you have to convey from the outset that this is not a permanent solution. Your hope is that with support, perhaps some combination of counseling and medication, he'll be able to live on his own. You'll have to set a timeline for that. If he is just going through the motions, you'll know soon enough. If he genuinely commits, you can decide together what independence looks like and how he might get there. And if your brother, with his big brain and big ideas, continues to spin his wheels, in truth, the line between care and enabling is often blurry, and you're the one best placed to judge how your brother might respond to the withdrawal of your hospitality. You can connect him with organizations and resources that might catch him if he falls. You wouldn't just be leaving him to flounder alone, yet you're not obligated to sacrifice your own well-being indefinitely, and Your compassion risks sustaining his arrested development while allowing your own life to contract around his needs. Giving him a permanent crash pad can keep him from finding his own feet and from having a real shot at building a life of his own. And here is how one of the readers responded to this ethical dilemma. And this is from Michael Yu in Boston. The letter writer and ethicist both seem to harbor the fantasy that this man, now in his 50s, can get better if the writer stops enabling him and he gets therapy for his issues. Let's face it, after 20 years, it's highly unlikely that he will ever improve. My suggestion is more pragmatic. Rather than continue to let him couch surf, could the writer and their numerous siblings pool their resources to provide him with a small apartment and stipend to live independently? If not in this country, then in another where living costs are lower? It could be conditioned on his holding a job of some sort. Even minimum wage would help. It seems to me this is the only alternative, either to having the brother live with them indefinitely or seeing him become homeless. And that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.